Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
It'll never be the four of us again. The end of an era.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 556 for the week of March 31st, 2025. I am the show that killed Linda Lavin, David Teagle. And I'm here with emotional support chicken, Sarah D. Bunting.
Putting the cock back in.
Chauvet innkeeper, Tara Ariano.
It's French.
And Fisties regular, Joe Reed.
Come here often.
Oh my god, welcome to Extra Hot Great, the most tasteful podcast you listen to.
Love, she's dead, she's not gonna know.
You know what, I feel like she would find that pretty funny, honestly.
She didn't.
Yeah, I hope so.
Joining us, he is a writer and a game maker at Vulture. He is a co-host of the podcast that's had Oscar buzz and Demi, Myself, and I, and he is our beloved dear friend. It's Joe Reed.
Welcome back, Joe.
Hi. Ooh, Joey Apollo.
Thanks for having me.
We're delighted to have you to talk about Mid-Century Modern, in which, after George dies at home in Palm Springs, his best friend Bunny, Nathan Lane, invites the other two members of their squad, flight attendant Jerry, Matt Bomer, and ex-Vogue editor Arthur, Nathan Lee Graham, to give up their homes in Atlanta and New York, respectively, and move into Bunny's bungalow. Already living there is Bunny's mother, Sybil, Linda Lavin. So, yes, in case you were wondering, the Golden Girls comparisons are very intentional. Also, the guys are all gay and dating, not each other. The show was co-created by David Cohan and Max Muchnick, who previously made Will and Grace together. Ryan Murphy is among its executive producers. All 10 episodes dropped on Hulu on March 27th. We may talk about events from any of them. We've already talked about events from one of them. Let's do check in. Joe, should our listeners watch Mid-Century Modern?
Short answer, yes.
Sarah?
Short answer, yes.
Dave?
Not great, Bob.
Okay. It's a yes for me as well. I thought it was fun. Let's get into it. Joe, I don't think it's doxing you to say you do a regular trip to Palm Springs with friends who are also gay guys. What was it like to watch your real life depicted on screen like this?
I was going to say, thank you for inviting me to talk about a show about gay people who aren't getting any younger moving to Palm Springs, because it does feel like in a best case scenario, this feels like my future. Mm-hmm. I do love it. Every time I go to Palm Springs, I do have the thought of like, I should live here. Mm-hmm. Like, it would be so nice. It does it as well as a, you know, sitcom can do it, right? It has the, it doesn't really get into like just how quirky Palm Springs is. Like there's like the lifers there. It's a, mm-hmm. it's an odd collection of folk, and it's not even exclusively just the gay folk, but like there are kooky straight folks who live out there too. Mm-hmm. But I think it gets into the spirit of, you know, what it would be like for, you know, in a sitcom, in a, you know, in the idiom of sitcom, mm-hmm. for these three later in life, men, asterisk with Matt Bomer. Matt Bomer is significantly.
And Nathan Lee Graham, who's probably like only in his 50s.
They make it make sense. And I think that's one of the things that I think is good about it. I think one of the things that I like about this show existing as a fairly traditional sitcom is, mm-hmm. like those kinds of shows, it coalesces as it goes.
Yeah.
It kind of, you know, it finds itself as it goes. It's not quite fully formed when you first get to it. And I find that charming.
Yeah.
I think certain performances get better. I think Bomer finds his character a little bit more.
Agree.
I think they draw the relationships of the characters to each other more specifically as the season goes along. It's not this great show.
Mm-hmm.
I described it the other day to somebody as like the perfect, I'm too hungover or too tired to leave this couch TV show.
What an endorsement.
Look, that has its uses.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm into it.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. I hope it comes back.
I do too. I agree with everything you said. I thought it was really charming. And the fact that the creators knew that Linda Lavin wasn't well meant that they sort of had built in a contingency plan, as it were, for what did eventually happen, which is she passed away while they were mid shooting the season. And so the 9th episode is about her character's death. And they used her, Linda Lavin's actual last words to her husband as her last words. Yeah. When she said, I want you to live. That's what she actually said to her husband on the way to the hospital, which is, you know, that's sweet. I know.
Yeah.
So sweet.
Yeah.
But the contingency plan, I think it's pretty obviously Pamela Adlon, who plays Bunny's sister, Mindy, a divorcee who is not totally sold on Palm Springs, but they talk her into moving there. And so at the end, it's like, you should move into mom's room. And she's like, no, but I feel like if there's a season two, it's going to be probably yes.
Seems likely. Seems likely. Or at the very least, she'll just be like there local enough that like she's a constant pop in.
She's
like,
around.
Serve the same function.
Exactly. Yeah. Sarah, you were short answer. Yes. What's the long answer?
The long answer is that I don't think we need another like iteration of the Golden Girls. Like we have the Golden Girls. It is on like TV Land is basically the Golden Girls channel.
Yeah.
At this point, parentheses complimentary. So we don't need this, but I will say, like, if you feel like you're going to be bothered by how many parallels there are and how close it is in all the ways that Tara just mentioned in the rundown up top, maybe that's not going to be for you. If that's going to be like off-putting or you think there's going to be an uncanny valley thing. But if you're going to rip from the best and they do, like it is actually, I don't think it is trying to be a copy, but I think it also understands that that is the parallel, that is the comp. And so they might as well do it as thoroughly and well as they can. And I think it succeeds. These are very likable performers. The Golden Girls is a classic and I still love it. And so maybe this isn't necessary to do it in this iteration, but it was such a sort of welcoming experience that it's like you understand all these rhythms. You understand all these people and what they tend to do. And you understand that it's like technically the Rose / Matt Bomer is too dumb to live on his own. But in the context of this sitcom, which has very traditional things that it is trying to do and succeeding, I think it really works.
The other thing I was going to say is I sort of walked into this show I had my walls up a little bit because the Will and Grace reboot really. I was excited for that to come back too, and I really felt kind of burned by that. And I was very wary of this idea of Max Muchnick and David Cohan sort of talking about one of the things that I thought was so bad about the Will and Grace reboot was it felt like it had this responsibility to like address every aspect of gay life from this like generation gap perspective and whatever. And I thought like, oh God, this, you know, because so much of Mid-Century Modern is about the fact that they're older, I was like, is this just going to be like, we don't understand young gays for 10 episodes in a row? And it pulls back, it doesn't really go there in that direction at all. And it actually has a few instances in which it seems sort of like a little bit wise about those kinds of things, but mostly it just sort of like stays in its lane.
Yes.
In a way, no pun intended, but in a way that like, I appreciate it. It doesn't try so hard to like speak to the moment with one exception, which I think is probably the weakest episode of the season, where they have the congresswoman played by Stephanie Koenig, who the tone is off in that episode. Yeah. And even that episode sort of ends on a sort of refreshing level of like, you're not giving me, you had the head fake towards like, we're going to have a message. And at the end, it's just like, oh no, like we're blackmailing her.
Yeah, fuck this bitch.
She was pegging that Bomer, which like, who among us?
Yeah. I mean, there's a way in which a multicam show like this, you can summarize the storylines in three words, like, or four. Mm-hmm. Arthur needs a job.
Right.
So he, you know.
Right.
Bunny lost at blackjack. Like, it doesn't have to, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. And this is not to be yelling at the bear again, but like, everything doesn't need to be important, you know, air quotes important.
Right.
Like, sometimes things can just be stupid and fun. And that's also fine.
And even the episode where, like, I mean, it's another four-worder, like Jerry meets his daughter. But like, even that one, I think, has a really good balance of that more serious stuff. And then it's like Arthur's playing flight attendant, which is so funny. And Sherry O'Terry is, I think, kind of a hoot as the other flight attendant. So I think that kind of stuff, you know, works in the show's favor. It's not refined. It's not, you know, elevated in any way.
Yeah.
But I think within that milieu, it sort of works.
My notes had something along the lines of no low-hanging fruit is left unharvested. But that's fine. Like, it's hanging right there. You have to pick it.
Yeah.
And they do.
Mm-hmm.
Also, as somebody who has vacations in Palm Springs, like, we're not above dumb top-bottom jokes. We're just not. Like, we can pretend that we're, you know, too good for that. And, like, I roll my eyes at those with the best of them. But, like, we all succumb to the low-hanging fruit. Again, no pun intended.
Well, that is something I wondered about, whether your impression of it would be that this was, like, a show about gay characters for a straight audience, like Will and Grace, I think probably mostly was, especially in its day. So, you know, as the only person here that's qualified to answer that, like, tell us what you think. And bear in mind, you're speaking for your whole community. Your words have the force of law.
I was going to say, I'm an excellent representative of all aspects of the gay
community. That's why we call Joe the ambassador.
Smooth Joey ambassador.
Yep.
I do feel like there is a sort of relaxedness about it, which feels, which at least communicates to me less of an uptightness about we have to make sure that we are pitching our comedy to everybody and we're making this understandably enough. It's not, you know, levels deep, something like the other two, for example, which I think is a great show about lots of things, but one of the things it's about is like, it's some real, if you know, you know, stuff like about like gay community jokes. This doesn't go that deep, but I think there are certainly certain jokes in it that feel like they don't feel like they have to over explain the thing. You know what I mean? Like, fisties can just be fisties and it just sounds funny. You know what I mean? And they don't have to really feel like they have to, you know, go that extra mile and explain it. And I think there are a lot of jokes like that. And it just feels a lot more, again, relaxed than the Will and Grace reboot, which felt so manic all the time. And so sort of like it existed in quotation marks. It was like Will and Grace, you know what I mean? And it felt like not of itself. And this feels a lot more comfortable with itself.
Yeah. 100%. Will and Grace, the revival, definitely felt like everyone is counting on us to get this right. And it's like, no one is counting on you for anything. You're fucking Deborah Messing. Like,
right.
Shut up, first of all.
Yeah.
Nathan Lane, what a gift. Still such a great physical comedian. Like, the turning a line, of course he's a stage star. Of course he's going to be good in a multicam setting, like, which is like a little play of sorts. But, like, there's a moment in, I think, the second episode where someone startles him in the kitchen and he, like, sprays up all the cereals. Like, he just finds so many moments like that. He's so good. And, like, of course this is beneath him, air quotes. Like, he can and has done more elevated stuff than this. But it's so it's just nice to see him seeming like he's enjoying himself, you know, goofing around in this setting.
Did he ever do, like, a sitcom in the 90s for any length of time?
The sitcom you might be thinking of is Charlie Lawrence from 2003, six episodes in which opera singer who loses his voice goes to live with his mother and sister in Napa Valley, where they run a winery.
Opera singer sounds familiar. I didn't watch it, of course. But
again,
yeah.
Great cast. Ted McGinley, T.R. Knight, pre-Grey's Anatomy. Wow. Laurie Metcalf, guys.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think you're not a nice person, but give me a hug anyway. Your family's now the official tagline for my life. Little Laughing. Also a joy in this. I don't know if anyone else watched far enough to see the episode where she has dinner with her at the country club with her friend Judy, who's played by Rhea Perlman.
Rhea Perlman. I did see that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They have a fight, and then when they later see each other, they're like on opposite sides of the dining room, flipping each other off in various elaborate ways.
So
like
good.
Linda Lavin great. Is so committed to the turning a crank middle finger yep. gag that like she gives it just their ultimate utmost. You know, if that's one of the last, you know, comedic bits she puts in her career, put it on the reel because it's worth it.
It is time for Around the Dial. But before we start, I forgot to mention one thing, which is don't put a doorknob in the middle of your door.
But that is a California thing.
I don't care where you are. Doorknobs in the doorknob place. It's Doorknob and Eve, not Doorknob and Steve. All right, found the dial time. Tara, you're first.
So because I write for a comedy site, I've been dimly aware of the Last One Laughing series on Prime Video. I've never been interested in checking out the versions from Italy, Mexico, Ireland, Spain, Denmark, Australia, or Canada, which has both an English and a French version. But then last week, we all got LOL UK, and when I saw the cast of mostly Taskmaster alumni, I knew we had to watch at least one. Oops, we watched the whole season this weekend. Basically, it's only six episodes. It's Big Brother, except A, all 10 contestants are comedians. B, they're only in the fake house environment for 6 hours, which is why, like, it's hilarious. They make them all come with, like, a little suitcase. Like, you're going to be gone by dinner time. It's fine.
Full of beer. Sure.
Perhaps. And C, the many hidden cameras are monitoring everyone because they're not supposed to laugh. As the title suggests, the last one to get through it without laughing wins a cheap trophy and bragging rights. And these are naturally funny people who like to laugh and who all know each other at least a little, if not personally, definitely professionally. So it's possible they might eventually just let their guard down naturally and laugh in conversation. And that happens pretty quickly with a couple of them before they start to figure out, oh, I actually have to pay attention. The first time a player laughs, the game stops down so that everyone can laugh as they watch the footage of the laugh and talk about it. And then the host, Jimmy Carr, comes in to give them a yellow card. And the second time a player laughs, they're out and they have to go sit with Jimmy and his honestly mostly useless co-star, Roshan Conaty, in a sort of control room lounge to watch and comment on the rest of the shoot. But since the first couple of boots would probably make everyone pay more attention to their reactions, there are structures in place to make people more likely to break. Everyone is supposed to have arrived with what they're calling a joker, where they go to a stage and they perform a little prepared bit. Harriet Kemsley does a comic stripping routine. Bob does magic and keeps... like very bad and he keeps going shh for no reason. Like,
Bob Mortimer.
So stupid. Yeah, Bob Mortimer. These are extremely stupid in a way I can't clip for the audio format. Players also get challenged in mini games, like when Lou Sanders and Joe Lycett have to get on stage, maintain eye contact, and give each other compliments. And I almost clipped this one, but I didn't want to spoil it. It's so funny. Or Joe Wilkinson has to stay put on the naughty chair, while everyone whispers in his ear, stuff like that. So at some point, Daisy Mae Cooper locks in on the strategy of just arranging her face to look really mad. So whenever the camera cuts to her, clearly chewing her cheeks while scowling, it's very rewarding. And that's truly, that's it. There's hardly anything to the show other than seeing people being pleasurably tortured, and the joy of it is similar to what you get out of watching a blooper reel. Seeing people having fun is fun, and the stuff that makes them laugh, like that actually makes them break, it's unpredictable every single time. So the whole season's up on Prime. I'm already fantasy casting future UK seasons while still not caring at all about any version from any other nation.
When they get eliminated, is there a giant sound effect of Jimmy Carr's very weird laugh?
That no, happens? But he talks about that in like the first 2 minutes of the show. Yes.
Okay.
That he's the perfect person to do this because everyone wants him to not laugh, something like that.
Yeah.
For my plug, I also reviewed Side Quest, which is the spinoff of Mythic Quest. And you can read what I thought about that. The show notes. It was
I watched one fine. Of them and it was the least funniest thing from a comedy property I've seen in a long time.
Oh,
it was
no.
so
yeah.
But it wasn't like offensive or like bad. It was just like, it was like, seriously, I was like, why did that just happen?
Yeah.
Why? Exactly. Why was that produced?
Content for content's sake,
I guess.
Mm. Well, I mean, my theory about it, and I wrote about this, is like everyone, in my opinion, overpraises the Mythic Quest episodes that are like the departure every season, where it's like, this one is off model. This is like not even characters from the show. Isn't this so interesting? It's like, sure. Like, yeah. Those are never my favorite.
So many shows. That happens to so many shows. Yes. It's crazy.
So I feel like this was just like four pitches for departure episodes of the regular show, and they were like, none of these is good enough to be in a Mythic Quest season, so let's just do this because Apple's throwing money at us, I guess. And, you know, fine, I guess.
I'm going to report back to Catherine Van Arendonk that you've been using departure episodes correctly, which is she'll be very happy. She'll send you a fruit basket or something.
I mean, I know that she has a drone sniper that's just like circling the house all the time.
She's right off camera with just like a gun just pointed
at you. Anything that even rhymes with bottle, she's going to lay you up.
All right, Ambassador Joe, what do you got?
Yes. So we're 1 month past the Oscars, which means I have flipped the dial from Oscars to Emmys.
He's got
to
get his fix. put it in me.
And mostly this means that, like, now that I've stopped catching up on movies, I now have to start catching up on TV shows. All the shows that I was like, I'll watch it once the Oscars are over. And now it's like, God, they're all here. And there's so many of them. I have a horrifying spreadsheet that I have, where it's just like, I've listed each individual episode just so I have the satisfaction of being able to check them off. So I feel like I'm making some progress. But there have been some good ones. I caught up on all of Shrinking, because I had never even started that one. And Tara, I know I texted you about this. I didn't expect it to have as much of a Cougar Town vibe as it does. Mm-hmm. It is, in its best moments, it feels very hangouty in a way that Cougar Town was. It sort of scratches that itch.
Yeah, Shrinking is great when it's not about psychiatry. Everything doesn't have to be important. It's like, stop fucking this up.
100% agree with you. Another Ted McGinley, good use of Ted McGinley on TV. He fits in really well with that ensemble.
My favorite character.
Oh, I mean, yeah, obviously. Mm-hmm. I watched, it was only four episodes, but then the Netflix limited series Adolescence, which is about the aftermath of a elementary school or junior high kid who kills someone. And it is, as you might expect, dark. Mm-hmm. And it's all, each episode is also filmed in fake one take, which deeply annoyed me from the start, but I thought really works in one of the four episodes. It only being four episodes, it was nice to sort of like get in and out with that. And I liked it by the end better than I thought I was going to at the beginning. That's going to be, I think, a big Emmy contender this year, sort of doing the, Baby Reindeer. I think it's going to sort of like follow the Baby Reindeer trajectory. But the one I liked the best, and I know you've talked about this on this podcast before, but I am so into The Pit.
So good. It's so
good.
Show of the year.
I caught up with it because I was, when I started watching it, it was like 11 episodes in. I have access to the screeners, but I do like watching up to where Live is so I can talk about it with other people. And since I don't have to write about it at this moment, I don't need to get ahead. But I caught up to Live, and so I watched last week's episode, and now I'm like, I'm white knuckling it to this next one. I'm just like, we gotta get to the next one. And we're at
like
such
a
crucial
moment.
Alarm
that's like, here it is.
Ugh. It's so good. I immediately clocked what's her face, Dana, as being the cop from the Seinfeld episode where he gets the lie detector test about Melrose Place, which is one of my favorite, if not my favorite, Seinfeld episode of all time. Mm-hmm. There's a whole bunch of people. One of the other things I've been doing in Trump version 2 is watching old soap opera episodes on YouTube to sort of like escape. And there are so many like little one-off soap opera actors who show up on The Pit in a way that really reminds me of like old school Law and Order, where you can just like watch any old Law and Order and it's just like soap stars just popping up everywhere. It's so satisfying. I was sort of worried that especially in binging the show, that it was going to sort of hit me in my medical anxiety place where I watch a medical show for too long and all of a sudden I'm self-diagnosing like crazy, and it's just like it gets really, really bad.
I have ovarian cancer.
I'm positive for rats.
Right.
Well, you know, you and your sketchy Korean moisturizers are always going on about.
Yeah. That's no more.
It's a problem, Joe. We got to talk about it.
But it really, I think it's so satisfying on a process level. And It feels like you are in, even with, first year residents and these really sort of like green folks, you do feel like you're in the hands of a very overwhelmed, but still dedicated, group of professionals.
Yep.
I need to know just very quickly, thumbs up or thumbs down, where are we on Santos at this point?
In what regard? Do we like them?
Do we like her? Do we like her?
I'm pro Santos.
Mm. Okay.
Eh.
I was very anti Santos, and they're just starting to maybe bring me around on her. But like, even in this last one where she just like goes fully ahead with this like insane, risky, procedure, or whatever. I'm just like, you're going to get someone killed. You're loose cannon. I don't know.
Something. I mean, you're not supposed to like her. I mean, obviously, she's written to be the heel of those four.
She was right about the drug addict, but like, he was also right about her. She's not a team player, and you got a team player for this. So, like,
but I do appreciate that it's like,
oh, me too.
Yeah. I don't know. They're just willing to leave everyone kind of like, oh, this is like anybody. Sort of like three quarters of the time you're good, and then the rest of the time you're a jackass.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
And to be sure, I like a bad character.
I mean, you're on record. Pete Campbell is your favorite.
Pete Campbell is the best part of Mad Men. Santos is a great part of the pit. Exactly.
No, it's true. The show needs someone with that to bring that energy to it. And, there would definitely be at least one person like that in a group of medical students.
Right. But she's not like cartoonish. Like she concentrates on her craft, but then also there's all this other sort of medical conspiratorial stuff going on around her, the electrons going around her head all the time, or like, Freemasons run the country. And I enjoy that alchemy.
Yeah. I look forward to seeing what they do with her in season two.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, same. As far as plugs, you mentioned my cavalcade of podcasts. I have This Had Oscar Buzz still going strong. We are approaching our annual May miniseries, which we haven't announced yet, and we're still sort of fine-tuning, so I won't say what it is, but every May we do sort of a group of themed episodes, so I'm looking forward to what that is.
All Tom myself and I,
yeah, exactly. All Tom Wopat all the time. Demi, Myself, and I is my podcast on the films of Demi Moore that turned out to be even better timed than I thought it was going to be this year.
I'll say.
We are just now, most recent episode was on the film Striptease. So we are now getting to the point where her sort of leading lady days are ending. So it'll be an interesting period of time as we move ahead. And then at Vulture, I am doing, like I said, I'm doing Emmy Award stuff. I'm doing Cinematrix. I'm doing all sorts of stuff. I'm really enjoying myself. I love working there. So come read me over at vulture.com.
Sarah, what have you been watching?
I watched Gone Girls, not all of it. This is the Netflix three-parter on the Gilgo Beach serial murder case. Comes to us from director Liz Garbus. I really hoped that I would have kinder things to say about it, not least because I really wanted to have kinder things to say about the previous run that she took at this case 5 years ago. That was Lost Girls, a scripted outing based on Robert Kolker's brilliant book. And it was kind of more about the living victims of the killer, who at that point we still didn't know who it was.
Is that the one with Amy Ryan? Sorry to interrupt you.
It is. No, I did watch that. Sorry. It was. I talked about it on The Blotter Presents. It was like me and Kevin Smokler being like, why don't we like this? Like very gently sort of trying to tap around, like, why don't we like this? Because we really like her. I didn't love that. I respected what it seemed to be trying to do. And I really hoped, like, because she is better known as a documentarian and has done brilliant work in the genre, produced the adaptation of Elon Green's Last Call for HBO. And I thought that was extremely well done. This updated look at the case will probably deliver, right? Well, I mean, yes, but the key information here is not so much what it's about or who it's from, but where it is and how many parts it is. And the Netflix three-parter part, unfortunately, is the key intel. Like I said, I haven't quite finished it, but it does have a bunch of true crime AV cliches already. It does seem like it could have done what it needed to in a single 110-minute serving versus three at 50 minutes each. And if the rubric here is whether this true crime is worth your time, this isn't, if you have followed the case or consumed other materials about it. There are half a dozen other ways to come at the story that make points that want making about law enforcement intransigence, profiling sex workers in the crimes committed against them, profiling them as criminals, the limits of behavioral profiling period, Long Island's culture. But unfortunately, there's like a flattening, like a Netflixening that can occur in defiance of the creator that just kind of flattens out the story into like, well, here's that shot of someone way over to the side of frame with all the tech visible. And it's like, why are we doing this? And also, why is Robert Kolker agreeing to do this? I mean, it's just kind of a predictable three-part shape. And so, yeah, if you have been following the case, you don't need it. And if you haven't been following the case, I would actually start with the A&E version made by Josh Zeman, if you can find it, because they at least, I don't know, like tried to do something different before the network networked and was like, no, you're not allowed to do anything creative on basic cable. Anyway, yeah, that's Gone Girls on Netflix, and no rush watching that. For my plug, if you are not on our Patreon, I really feel that you should be, but there's some economic uncertainty in the world right now. Maybe you heard something about that. So the original Admiral Anonymous, our anonymous donor to the Extra Hot Great Mutual Aid Vault, has been joined by a whole fleet of Admiral Anonymy. And so if you would like to join us on the Patreon or renew your subscription, but you feel like you can't afford it, there are deposits in the Bank of Extra Hot Great waiting for you. So whether you want to withdraw or deposit to the vault, just get in touch with me, bunting@tomatonation.com by email, or if you are already on the Discord, you can direct message me there.
Are we a federally insured bank?
No.
Okay, good. All right, here's what's coming up on this Friday's Extra, Extra Hot Great. We were talking about Mobland. That is one word, intercapped, Mobland. I believe intercapped, so it doesn't look like Mobland. Is it Mobland or is it Mobland? We will discuss this Friday. You can catch it yourself before we start talking about on Paramount Plus. Extra, Extra Hot Great drops every Friday, is available to club members. Go to extrahotgreat.com/club to join up or contact Sarah if you want to take advantage of the mutual aid vault that we have running here. And then come back next week right here on EHG Prime. We'll be talking about the TV show Dying for Sex. And we have new guest Katie Rich joining us. Yeah.
Joe, not familiar.
Yeah, I was going to say, who?
quick plug from me. Season 2 of Glowing Briefcase is going to start next Monday, as you were hearing this. I'm happy to say Dan Casino's in for game creation. We are going to test a easier to more difficult Monday to Friday schedule. And Dan will be handling Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And I have read his first Friday quiz. And at the end of it, I was a little bit mad about it. So if you love pop culture and trivia and you are listening to this and you're a club member, that's who we were letting in at the moment while we do these beta tests. So either you can sign up on the Discord. There is a post from last month on our Patreon. Just search for Glowing Briefcase. You'll find it. Sign up directions there. And we hope to see you. It is, in theory, a competitive landscape, but we try to have more fun than we do worry about leaderboards there and stuff like that. So some of the scoring is a little silly. Some of the questions are a little silly. If that feels like it's your jam, we would love to see you there.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
Oh, spooky backwards music can only mean one thing. It is time for the Extra Hot Great Nonak, in which we take a show that is usually well-regarded, and we discuss whether a particular episode is cram it with walnut style. Presenting this week, it is Mr. Joe Reed. Joe, take it away.
Before I get started, I feel like there's a quick parameter setting that I feel like probably has to be done, which you are free to accept or not, and in your deliberations as you see fit. So I'm presenting an episode of The Simpsons for the Nonak. Now, The Simpsons is a show that is quite literally on its 36th season. Yes. I am breaking no ground by saying that the show has not been able to maintain its standard of quality over its entire run. I stopped watching many, many years ago. I imagine everybody on some level or another followed suit.
Correct.
There does seem to be somewhat of a widely accepted notion that there is classic Simpsons and there is modern Simpsons. And we often talk about them as if they are two separate shows. While there isn't a universal agreement over which seasons constitute the so-called Simpsons golden age, the first 10-ish seems to be within the margin for error of this. And if I came to the table with a Simpsons Nonak submission from, say, season 19 or 22 or 400 or whatever, that wouldn't make a ton of sense, since a dud Simpsons episode from that era doesn't exactly stand out. What I'm submitting is a dud Simpsons episode from that so-called golden age or thereabouts, and I'm hoping you'll be able to evaluate its relative merits from within those parameters.
I agree to your terms, Joe.
Yep, that makes sense. Right. I assumed some kind of table setting like this was coming.
So I'm going to take us back to season 8 of The Simpsons. At this point, we haven't gone off the cliff yet, but the quality has become a bit more uneven. The balance of good episodes to not good is still very much in favor of the show. We get some incredible highs this season. This is a Milhouse Divided, which is, of course, the very first canon episode that we ever did. The Twisted World of Marge Simpson, my beloved Pretzel Wagon episode, Itchy and Scratchy and Poochie is this year, Homer's Phobia, Brother from Another Series, etc. And then there are some that are that feel, you know, tonally off. I talk about, like, My Sister, My Sitter a lot, where, like, Lisa babysits Bart and nearly kills him or whatever. There's a lot of, like, oh, maybe Lisa will date Nelson. Maybe Marge and Reverend Lovejoy will run a church helpline. Maybe Mr. Burns will get into recycling. You know, all this. These episodes may show strain, but they're not awful. And even if I might sometimes skip them to get to a really good episode, if I find myself seated with the remote far enough away from me, I won't try to rig an elaborate Rube Goldbergian contraption to try and get the remote back in my hand so I can hit the episode forward button.
Is this when you're hungover, like you were mentioning earlier?
Exactly, when I'm in a real mid-century modern mood. the exception to this rule, and the lowest point by a good margin in this season, and I would also venture in the so-called Simpsons golden era, is episode 13 of season 8, titled Simpson Califragilistic Expiala Annoyed Gruntius. So, point number one, even the episode title is annoying. The inside joke is that annoyed grunt is what they put in the script for when Homer says dope. So it's supposed to be Simpsons Califragilistic Expiala Docious. And a title like that already has two jokes in it. It simply cannot bear the weight of a third additional joke. It just cannot. Just call it the one with Sherry Bobbins and get the hell on with it already. So the nutshell plot description is that the needy and slovenly habits of Homer, Bart, and Lisa, Maggie largely innocent,
are driving Marge's hair to fall out in large, unseemly clumps from stress. And so the family decides to get a nanny and thus plunges the episode headlong into a Mary Poppins parody, complete with a brand new character named Cherry Bobbins, voiced by Maggie Roswell, and songs all very thinly adapted from the original Disney film. I'd elaborate on the plot further, except that's kind of just it, which segues into my next point, which is there is not any story here beyond just tracing the lines of Mary Poppins. I understand that this is not the show's first foray into Marge is put upon and underappreciated as a wife and mother. It's been tackled in everything from Marge in Chains, where she accidentally shoplifts a bottle of Colonel Quickie Mart's Kentucky Bourbon, gets sent to jail, or Marge on the Lam, where she strikes up a friendship with the next door neighbor and they stay all night shooting antique cans and driving into the Grand Chasm. It does feel like writers Al Jean and Mike Reiss's solution to finding something new to say on this topic is to just head fake towards Marge losing her hair before abandoning Marge entirely in favor of this flimsy Mary Poppins parody. Bart and Lisa are sort of generally ill-behaved and lazy in this episode, but everything they do feels so sweatily retrofitted to the Mary Poppins narrative, starting with their song about nanny requirements, which is clip number one.
If you wish to be our sitter, please be sweet and never bitter. Help us with math and book reports.
Might I add, eat my shorts.
Bart is cutting through the treacle.
If Maggie's fussy, don't avoid her.
Let me get away with Moiter.
Teach us songs and magic tricks.
Might I add, no fat chicks.
Homer!
The nanny we want is kindly and sage.
And one who will work for minimum wage.
Hurry, nanny, things are grim.
I'll do it!
Anyone but him.
So this brings me to my next and I think most damning point, number three. The songs are not funny, like shockingly so not funny. Eat My Shorts, it is a joke in the eighth season, not funny. The Simpsons set a high standard for itself when it comes to its songs, from the monorail to the Stonecutters to the Maison Derrière. And the offerings in this episode are just way below standard. Cut Every Corner is a gloss on A Spoonful of Sugar, whose best punchline is a tired beat about American laziness. Clip number two.
All right, children, let's clean up this room.
Oh, man, do we have to?
Now, I know a little secret that will make the job go twice as fast. If there's a task that must be done, don't turn your tail and run. Don't pout, don't sob, just do a half-assed job. If you cut every corner, it is really not so bad. Everybody does it, even Mom and Dad. If nobody sees it, then nobody gets mad.
It's the American way.
I'll grant that the hook of this episode is, you know, get a load of how the irreverence of The Simpsons sows chaos within the parameters of even a Disney classic. But if that's the case, that is a dusty old notion that feels better suited to seasons two or three, back when, like, George H.W. Bush was railing against Bart Simpson for teaching our kids too much sass mouth or whatever. There also isn't time for very many songs in a half an hour episode, so it feels weird that the show chooses to prioritize, for example, a Feed the Birds knockoff rather than the more memorable songs like Chim Chim Cheree or the actual Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. But I guess that would have deprived us of Barney being hilarious in clip number three.
Buy me a beer, $2 a glass. Come on, help me, I'm freezing my ass. Buy me brandy, a snifter of wine. Who am I kidding? I'll drink turpentine.
just as an aside, I know Matt Groening has talked about a lot about how he hated the Barney character and sort of the one-noteness of his sort of alcoholism. And I think moments like this were sort of made to sort of press on those buttons and just shove it in your face, essentially, that like you're laughing at an alcoholic. But regardless, not funny. Point number four, Sherry Bobbins is on a character level inconsistent and unfunny. Obviously, they need to do something with Sherry Bobbins to differentiate her from the movie character, but the writers never seem to land on what that is. Sometimes she's impatient with the kids and snaps at them about not being a bloody jukebox. Other times she's placid and impervious, like when she encounters ex-flame groundskeeper Willie in the park. Still other times she's wasted away in Margaritaville. Unsurprisingly, the groundskeeper Willie stuff is the one thing in this episode I did find funny, so I clipped that for number four.
Sherry Bobbins, is that you?
Hello, Willie.
You'd know her?
Hey, Sherry Bobbins and I were engaged to be wed back in the old country. Then she got her eyesight back. Suddenly the ugliest man in Glasgow wasn't good enough for her.
It's good to see you, Willie.
That's not what you said the first time you saw me.
Justice for Willie. The episode arrives at a fake ending 2/3 of the way through, where it seems like Sherry Bobbins has gotten the Simpson family shipshape and Marge's hair is secure in her beehive, but mere seconds after she leaves, the house descends into anarchy, and with a weary sigh, Sherry checks back in for another shift at the Cracker Factory. Because she's so dedicated to her job? Like, what happened to cut every corner? What happened to not being a bloody jukebox? Is the idea that Sherry Bobbins is a budget Mary Poppins who isn't all that virtuous, or does she genuinely want to help, but is thwarted by the indomitable dysfunction of the Simpsons family? Who is this character? Why should I care if she's frustrated? Point number five, this episode requires the Simpsons to be awful people and not in a fun way. I'm not going to delve deeply into jerk-ass Homer theory, except to briefly say that it posits that at one point, the balance of the Homer character tipped from dumb, oblivious, occasionally small-minded, but mostly well-intentioned, to egregious jerk whenever the show needs him to be. This episode sits uncomfortably in that pocket, and it applies that quality to pretty much the whole family. And without good jokes to make up for it, the effect feels just weird and mean in clip number five.
Sherry Bobbins, I want another beer.
Well, you know, Homer, if there's a job that must be done, you'll find it's much more fun.
You'll find it's even more fun if you get it for me.
But the beer will taste more sweet if you get up off your seat.
Lady, the man asked for a beer, not a song.
Do-re-mi fa-so.
The episode ends with another unfunny song about how the Simpsons are happy being the lazy jerks that they are, and I guess Marge is just going to have to pony up for a lace front because nothing gets solved. And the tone of the song feels pretty defiant about it all. Clip number six.
Around the house, I never lift a finger. As a husband and father, I'm subpar. I'd rather drink a beer than win Father of the Year. I'm happy with things the way they are.
I'm getting used to never getting noticed. I'm stuck here till I can steal a car. The house is still a mess, and I'm going bald from stress. But we're happy just the way we are.
The episode even ends on an Armin Tamzarian-esque mandate to never revisit the story again, with a departing Sherry floating up into the sky and getting sucked into a jet engine.
That did make me laugh.
Fair enough. I do really hate this episode, though. It is both lazy and mean-spirited. It is slavish to its parody in a way that drains the lifeblood from the story, yet it offers no insight into the thing it's actually parodying. And to make matters even worse, it has a really underwhelming Quentin Tarantino joke in its itchy and scratchy interlude. Clip number seven.
What I'm trying to say in this cartoon is that violence is everywhere in our society. You know, it's like even in breakfast cereals, man.
That clip is funnier just audio than it is on the show.
Otherwise, that is my case. I will grant the possibility that this might just be a me thing and it just gets under my skin. But I'm eager to hear what you all feel about the Sherry Bobbins episode of The Simpsons.
Well, since Dave and I are obviously the more Simpsons sickos here, I feel like Sarah should go first.
Happy to. I was surprised initially that this was a no-nack. I did recognize the episode for what it was. And there are a couple of elements in it that I forgot were in it that have definitely like escaped into like Bunting family heavy rotation, like shut up, Landers, Oakley Doakley Doo. Like when my brother and his family and I all lived together, that was in regular, like multiple times a day adaptation. The you have my full attention, and then Homer and the turkey.
I do like that too. That
thing, I think you see that on social media as a meme a lot.
Yeah.
And like her just getting sucked into a jet engine. But like, here's the thing, that bit at the end where it's like, I'm sure she'll be back someday. And then in the background, it's like, it's compact. It gets in and out of the joke. And that's something that is not happening most of the rest of the episode, that the songs are extremely pleased with themselves, extremely like, I don't know, think they're very funny, but have no sense of humor about themselves and their own existence. I mean, you basically said this, but like, it's just a pacing issue for me. And especially in this era of The Simpsons, where, as noted, I think it is a little more hit or miss than in like season 5, say, but it's still more hit than miss. And when it's hit, it's because the joke density is correct. And after a certain point, I think I was at like season 9 when even my super fan then boyfriend was like, I don't think I can do this anymore. It's not funny enough for enough of the time. So I think we quit after the season premiere that year. But this is what people are talking about when they compare like golden age versus, I don't know, brown age, turd age. Like, this isn't bad. Is just nowhere near as good as Golden Age Simpsons could be. And it feels a lot longer than the runtime. The songs are not funny. You're absolutely right about at a certain point in that last act when she is returned to the house and they're all just being twats to her. It's like, but this isn't even, like, if you're going to sort of character assassinate your entire core cast, maybe I should have laughed at any point in the last 7 minutes, and I didn't really. So I think this is a really good presentation, and I think that you nailed everything that is like no-knack worthy about this, that it's not that it's that terrible, it's that it just misses on timing things, and as a result, it misses by a mile at the same time. Mm-hmm. This was not a good episode, but it was interesting to sort of tease out like, okay, what is the no-knack? What's the pitch here? How is Joe going to argue this? And then by, I don't know, 1/3 of the way through, I was like, yeah, I think I got the idea. And then there was another song that was so stentorously presented that I was like, oh my God, like open a window and stop smelling your own farts. Anyway, I think that you and I agree. Who is next?
I'll go next. To go back to what I said about Mythic Quest and getting overpraised for departures, I feel like we're starting to see this where, like, in early season 8, and it's going to get worse, is when they're trying to go back and, like, play the hits. And this is clearly an attempt to recapture the magic of See My Vest, which was from season 6. The Sherry Bobbins episode is not the first time they went to the parodying Disney well, and it was certainly done better the last time.
Yeah.
Which, with a combined 101 Dalmatians and Beauty and the Beast mashup, which, like, you know, that's clever. This is just like a straight up parody of songs that barely change the melody, even.
Well, and the visuals in See My Vest is like a whole thing, whereas, like, it's not even like that ambitious on a visual level in this thing.
Yeah. And this is the problem. Like, when you watch this episode, there are funny stuff that, you know, the black and white cartoon, the turkey is draw, hilarious. The Rainier Wolfcastle wiener ad still makes me laugh. The Willy moment made me laugh as well. Like, it's not that there aren't jokes, it's that when you actually watch it through a critical eye, and I, you know, maybe this is why people hate critics, sorry. But, like, there's stuff in here that's, like, bad. Maggie Roswell's English accent, bad. The animation on Marge's, like, skull when she's in Dr. Hibbert's office, like, it's caved in. Like, you can see, the joke is that you can see through her beehive because there's huge holes have fallen out. But, like, it just doesn't conform to even cartoon reality of what a skull looks like.
But I thought, like, the asides, you know, the joke asides in this episode feel very unearned compared to other episodes. So for me, even though it predates it, it feels like it's drifting into Family Guy territory with this episode. Yes. It has that vibe to it, which is, here's a funny notion. What does it have to do with what we're doing? Mm-hmm. Almost nothing. So what? Let's put it in.
Right.
And some of those are funny unto themselves, but like don't really gel into a full episode where you're like, well, that was a solid piece of business.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you compare the quality of this to even an early episode of the same theme, like Rancho Relaxo, or the one where Marge leaves Homer and then he makes a hedge march, and then his tatters rags get caught on her coffee table, when she doesn't leave, she kicks him out.
Kiss your birth mother. Kiss her.
Kiss her. There's so many better ways to this episode that I'm not one of the people who's like The Simpsons should be more real. I don't care. It's fine if Homer goes to space. Like whatever.
Right.
But if you're gonna do this theme, you need to do something that is better than what we've already seen you do on this, as you pointed out, exact storyline that's not repetitive, even including in the movie. Like that's basically what the Simpsons movie is about too.
Doesn't need to be real.
Right.
Absolutely agree. The elastic reality is what broke Simpsons out from most of the other stuff that had come before it.
Yes.
But they still have to be a family.
Right.
Like, that's the basis. It doesn't have to be real, but at the core, it still has to be about a family trying to get along or move forward or whatever. Mm-hmm. And this episode is absolutely not that.
Right, right. And to your point about the Family Guy thing, like, when Eat My Shorts makes it into the song, it's like the line from the episode where Lisa makes friends with the cool kids at the beach house, and then, you know, Bart overhears her say, "Don't have a cow, man," and Marge is like, "You haven't said that in years." Same with Eat My Shorts. Like, was a t-shirt, a slogan that got
that
run into the
89.
Ground by 8,000 t-shirts, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, you made a perfect case for this episode. And just to comment before I throw it to Dave, what a land of contrasts season 8 is. We've got You Only Move Twice, one of the best Simpsons episodes of all time, followed immediately by The Homer They Fall, which is the one where it's like the fake Mike Tyson.
Oh, God.
The Dredrick Tatum, who's like gotten a whole character redesign since the last time Dredrick Tatum was on the show. And I do hate it when they break continuity, and I am a nerd for that shit.
And it references that moment where the guy with the fan backpack parachuted into the boxing match, which is such a weird thing that nobody ever thinks about now. And the only reference I have for it is that Simpsons episode now.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
And anyway, so there are good episodes in season 8. This is definitely one of the worst. Dave.
The general problem with this episode is they do a half-assed job, like the line from the song. It's just not running on all cylinders. They're not hitting, and you can tell from watching it. And the things that do land are just these quick asides that don't add to the value of the whole. Like the Andy Griffith Charles Bronson mashup where he's going to go to Emmett Fix-It Shop to fix Emmett is funny. It makes me laugh, but it has nothing to do with why we're here.
I like every Charles Bronson joke they ever do on The Simpsons.
Yes. But, you know, there's lots of little goodies like that. Like, for some reason, Homer, like, Marge has got a beach umbrella in her hair, and Homer gets turned on. It's like, go upstairs. You're like, all right, just let me take off this beach umbrella. No, leave it in. That's funny.
Yeah.
You know, the milk and butt scratch thing is crass and dumb, but, you know, it's funny. When Marge is at the doctor and the phone rings for her on two different lines, and Bart's like, "I need a glass of milk." She hits line two. "Me too," says Lisa. Like, these are all quick, punchy, funny jokes, but they don't really add to what's going on in the core of this episode. And the fact that everybody emotionally is off model really sort of ruins the Mary Poppins of it all. I mean, including Mary Poppins as a model, but the Simpsons, they are too mean here, like all of them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We know Homer has gone from being a doofus to kind of a jerk sometimes now in season 8. But even so, like, that whole beer thing was like over the line for Homer, I thought. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of like missteps like that. And when you add all these things up, it is exactly a half-assed job. Like, it is very disappointing in that regard. And especially because like Mary Poppins is very, very parodiable. Like, parodiable. And you should be able to do a good job with it. But the songs, they just weren't there, or they went too long, or there were one note. So it just, unfortunately, just didn't pull together. Oh, can I be a booze hound? Not till you're 18. Another moment I like, but I couldn't tell you what episode that was in if I just didn't watch it. Like, that is that the moon landing episode? Maybe.
Right.
Like, it feels like I could have been one of those. So that's the problem with this. It's just like the Mary Poppins stuff is poor, and the parts that are funny are sprinkled in from like the joke shaker they have in the office, and it has nothing to do with what's going on this episode. So, all right. Let's make this official. Sarah D. Bunting, no knack worthy or not.
Shut up, Simpsons. yes, absolutely no knack worthy, in my opinion.
And Tara?
No knack.
All right. So what do you want, Joe? You want classic no knack success? You want karaoke version, or you want the Bonanza version?
Oh, God. Give me the karaoke version.
Da, da, da. All right, that means The Simpsons, Season 8, Episode 13. Oh, fuck me. Simpsons Califragilistic Expiala Annoy Gruntless. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great No Knack.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
All right. It is time to discover who is the winner and loser of the week. Sarah has this week's winner.
I do. I have a couple. It's a true crime casting coups. The first one is that Apple TV Plus's true crime con artist series Stowaway has cast Oscar Isaac as its lead. So really, the winner is me. And as well, the Murdaugh sons have been cast in Hulu's upcoming scripted Murdaugh Murder series, which I'm not sure that we need that, but Reacher alum Johnny Berchtold, is that how you pronounce that?
Mm-hmm.
Has been cast as one of the sons. So, yeah, I guess these things are moving along. I had forgotten all about the con man one, and I'm excited. So that's a winner.
America's love affair with true crime will never die.
I see what you did there.
And who's our loser of the week? Tara.
Well, I've been probably the foremost Citadel hater in culture, I feel.
You had business cards made up.
I did.
You're in the conversation, for sure.
They had embossing and everything. It was just like that scene from American Psycho.
In every way. So Citadel got renewed, I think, largely because they had spent so much money. They were like, we at Prime Video, that we can't not continue with this. We have to double down on this bet, literally. It also had multiple international spinoffs. Diana and Honey Bunny. I hate to even say it every fucking time. But anyway, Jennifer Salke, who greenlit all this, is out at Amazon. And now in her absence, they're like, just kidding about all this other Citadeliana that was supposed to be coming. So the main show is getting its second season pushed. The spinoffs are on hold, and I think they were going to do more as well. So, you know, kind of a mixed bag. Of course, I'm happy for this as a person who hated the show and doesn't think it should have happened and doesn't want more and doesn't want anyone else exposed to it ever, other than the times that I threatened to show it to Dave just so he can see what I'm so mad about. But that all of that is good. The bad part is, oh no, we are in a recession for real. They're not throwing any more money at this project.
The Citadel like, confidence index is in
exactly.
play.
Exactly. Yes.
Well, the solution to this would have been to go back at the start of Citadel.
Yeah.
And instead of doing whatever they did, they should have taken that same model, which I will remind you, I pitched before Citadel was a thing, this whole regional versions of the core show. Mm-hmm. It should have been G.I. Joe. It should have been G.I. Joe at the core, and then G.I. Joe Japan, G.I. Joe India, and G.I. Joe whatever. And that should have been the show, because then you have an IP people will actually watch.
Yes.
And you probably won't have to burden yourself with the, and I'm going to say it, Tara, the Russo-So brothers. And then you got a hit on your hands. Whoa. Amazon. Mm-hmm.
Dave, what if the alternate pitch to G.I. Joe is to do it Yellowstone style and do like G.I. Joe 1923, G.I. Joe 1910.
And they all have like their weird little stupid names and little gadgets and stuff. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. What would a G.I. Joe guy from the 20s be? Oh, Skidoo, the Skidoo guy, 23 Skidoo. He's on Skidoo. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, good. All right. I'm glad we cracked that one. Well, speaking about cracking that one, do you know what time it is?
It's good.
It's good time. This has been a very close season all season long. We're at our 10th game of the season. The scores are 3-3-3. Everybody has three.
My God.
Crazy, crazy, crazy.
Ooh.
Today we are playing Butcher Baker Candlestick Maker from Amy Allensbach, who earns herself yet another extra credit topic of her choosing, plus a free shirt from our store at throughmethods.com. She writes, in Butcher Baker Candlestick Maker, you will be tested on both occupations portrayed on television and the actress who played them. Your first clue will be two occupations that were played by the same actor on two different TV shows. Name the actor for 3 points. If you don't know it, play moves to the next person in line who gets a third occupation also played by that actor. Name the actor here for 2 points. If that player doesn't get it right, play moves to the third person in line who gets all the TV show titles in question. Answer here, 1 point. All right, can I get a steel mail count, please, Tara?
Yes, Sarah has 3, I have 3, valued guest has Eric's meal, so 1. Okay.
All right, and that does expire at the end of the day, so there's no penalty for a future value guess if you use it, Joe.
That meal is rapidly moldening on the on the countertop. You better eat it soon.
Right.
Steel meals can only be used today after the one-point question, just because of the nature of the game and how we switch who is answering. All right, that's how you play it. Let's throw it to Picky to see who's going first.
We will start with Sarah.
All right, we'll go Sarah, Joe, Tara. Remember your order in the queue so that you're ready if one person botches their guess. Yep. You will be on deck. We've got 24 questions today. We're going to do one Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zone right in the middle, worth 3 or 6 points, depending on how well you do. Question, Sarah Bunting.
Oh, actually, never mind.
Yeah, that's right. You only get one guess. Gotcha. All right. Are we ready to play Butcher Baker Candlestick Maker?
Yes.
Yes.
All right. Here we go. Sarah D. Bunting, I'm giving you two occupations. They were played by the same actor. You get one guess at it. No hints. Auditor and communications director. This actor, that is what you have to give me, played an auditor on one show and a communications director on another.
Communications director.
Yes, who is that actor?
Allison Janney?
Moving to Joe, your third occupation is firefighter.
Oh.
Auditor?
That changes.
Communications director?
Oh.
Firefighter.
Is it Rob Lowe?
It is.
No,
he was an auditor on Parks and Rec, communications director on The West Wing, and on 911 Lone Star, he was a firefighter slash station chief.
R.I.P. that shit.
All right. All right, that is 2 points for Joe. And Joe, you are now going to get your full question. You've got deputy mayor and attorney. So this actor played a deputy mayor and an attorney.
Okay. Michael J. Fox.
Is a 3-point answer. Yep. Yes, we also student that was a deputy mayor from Spin City, attorney from The Good Wife, student from Family Ties. Being a son, not an occupation. But being a parent is, guys.
The best
occupation. The biggest adventure, parenthood. All right. Tara.
Shout out to my mom, who's probably listening to this. I talked to her this morning, and she told me she would listen to last week's episode. She
shout out to Tara's mom.
Having just finished
shout
watching,
out to my mom, who's now going to haunt Dave.
She finished watching The Residents and then was like, oh, what we said was really interesting. I was like, oh, sorry.
All right, Tara.
Yeah.
Your two occupations are waitress and former psychologist.
Kaylee Cuoco.
Is a 3-point answer. Also had cabin crew member from Flight Attendant, psychologist from Harley Quinn, and Big Bang Theory waitress. Another 3-point answer back to Sarah. You've got doctor and lab supervisor and director. That is one job. Lab supervisor slash director.
John Noble.
Is not correct.
Good guess, though.
We move to Joe, who gets
my own phone.
Bar owner.
Lab supervisor slash director. Doctor.
Bar owner.
Bar owner. I'm going to guess with bar owner, Ted Danson.
You are correct. Oof. That was a doctor from Becker, lab supervisor, right. Director from CSI Original Rays Vegas.
Right.
And
right.
Bar owner from Cheers, Ted Danson.
Right.
All right, Joe, you've got your two occupations are prime minister and detective superintendent.
Sounds British. I suppose plausibly Canadian.
Those guys.
I'm going to throw out a guess and say Rory Kinnear.
That's incorrect.
That's what I would have guessed.
Way to play your judge, though.
Ryu.
Tara.
Yeah.
The third occupation is FBI agent.
Oh, no. Now I feel like I'm further away from it.
So, prime minister, detective superintendent, FBI agent.
Yeah. This isn't right, but Peter Capaldi?
It is not right. All right. Sarah, I'm now going to give you the shows involved. Prime minister on The Crown, detective superintendent on The Fall, and an FBI agent on The X-Files. Oh. Who is that actor for 1 point?
That is Gillian Anderson.
That is good. Nicely
the
done.
The doctor was his mother. His mother.
Tara.
Yeah.
Captain and senior attorney.
Really wanted the next thing you said to be Tennille. Captain and senior attorney. Andre Brower.
To Sarah with police officer. Captain.
William Shatner.
You are correct for 2 points. Nice. Yes.
Different
Kirk from Star Trek, Boston legal attorney, police officer, of course, TJ Hooker, everybody's favorite William Shatner property. Sarah, here's your full question. Your two occupations are gym owner and writer / book editor.
Leah Thompson?
No.
All right. Joe gets the third occupation, which is vice president.
Okay. Gym owner.
Gym owner, writer, book editor, vice president. Name the actor.
Man, New Adventures of Old Christine is a very different show if she's a gym owner, so I'm going to guess that's not it. Vice president. I'm going to say Gary Cole.
All right, now.
What?
Wait,
stop,
hang on.
Because I know it.
Okay.
What job do you think she has in New Adventures of Old Christine?
Oh, that's a very good question.
She's old Christine.
She seems...
Her job occupation is being
her job
old Christine.
Old. It's adventurer.
I'm going to give you a hint, Joe. It's something I just said.
Is it a book editor?
No.
Oh.
It's gym owner.
No, is it really?
All right, who are we talking about?
Me. It comes to me, and it's Julie Louis-Dreyfus.
Yes, gym owner from New Adventures of Old Christine.
Are you fucking kidding me?
Book editor from Seinfeld.
She owns a gym.
And vice president from Veep.
Yeah, she owns like a curves gym, a gym for women.
Could have had an hour to guess what she does in New Adventures of Old Christine. I wouldn't have gotten a gym owner. That's crazy.
You know what, Joe? Next time you're hungover, check that show out. You'll like it.
I know.
I'm telling you.
I know. Man, I'm going to have to do a lot of drinking to watch all these shows hungover that I'm going to promising I'm watching. So,
all right, Joe, here are your two occupations. This is your question. We have police inspector and cult leader. Cult leader.
Okay.
Not something you usually see on an employment form, but that was their occupation. Police inspector, cult leader.
Cult leader on TV.
Any idea?
Nicole Kidman.
All right. To Tara.
Good guess.
Police inspector, cult leader, advertising executive.
Oh my God. Oh, geez. Rich Summer.
You're going to be mad at this one. All right.
I'm sure I will.
Sarah DiBundy for 1 point.
I'm
police inspector from The Division. Never heard of it.
Oh, God.
Cult leader from Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Of course.
And advertising executive from Mad Men, Home of Pete Campbell.
Why didn't I just say it? I'm so stupid.
Who's that actor?
John Hamm?
John Hamm is correct for 1 point.
Indeed.
Juan Jamon.
All right, Tara.
Yeah.
Your two occupations are first lady and comedian. Who's that actor?
Jean Smart.
Jean Smart is correct for 3 points. First lady from 24, comedian from Hacks, receptionist, office manager from Designing Women, Jean Smart. Nice get. Sarah,
Here is your two occupations: spy and forensic psychologist.
Spy.
Yeah.
And forensic psychologist. Anatorf.
To Joe with the addition of paleontologist.
Spy, forensic psychologist, paleontologist.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was about to say don't overthink it, but I'm not that confident.
All right. Spy, forensic psychologist, paleontologist. Who is that actor, Joe?
Literally the only paleontologist I can think of is Ross on Friends, so I'm just going to say David Schwimmer and hope for the best.
No! All right, that's
incorrect.
What I thought too.
All right.
Shit.
Tara, for one point.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Spy from Archer.
Okay.
Forensic psychologist from Criminal Minds.
Yeah.
Paleontologist from Friends.
Aisha Tyler.
Yes.
Oh,
the
wow.
Second paleontologist.
The other paleontologist.
But he also was a spy in some British show with Nick Mohammed. That's why.
Was he really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Joe, here's your full question.
Something.
You've got cabinet member and private espionage operative.
Cabinet member, yeah. Private espionage operative.
Yeah.
Fancy ass way of saying spy. I'm going to say Taleone.
To Tara.
Yep.
We're adding former agent of the counter-terrorist unit. Or just agent of the counter-terrorist
okay,
unit. Okay. I don't know why I get so fancy.
Kiefer Sutherland.
You are correct, Kiefer Sutherland.
Oh.
Cabinet member, designated survivor. Remember that shit?
Sure. Yeah.
Private espionage operative. Anybody remember this one?
It's that show we watched.
We didn't watch it, but we saw lots of...
Oh, it's like Rabbit Hole or something?
Rabbit Hole. A lot of key art at the top of Paramount Plus.
Right.
And, of course, 24 for counterterrorism unit. All right, this will take us into our score break. It is for Tara to start. We've got forensic analyst and pediatric surgeon.
Forensic analyst. Pediatric surgeon. Marg Helgenberger.
To Sarah, we are adding funeral director, forensic analyst, pediatric surgeon, funeral director. Who is that actor?
Damn it.
Pediatric surgeon?
Yeah. I'm going to get hung up on that one. I've never heard of the show.
Oh, okay.
Although you put all these things together, it sounds like a real make-work project.
That's true.
Yeah. I'm just very torn between which one it is. So let's go with Peter Krause.
The other one.
All
right. The other one.
Damn it.
To Joe, forensic analyst from Dexter, pediatric surgeon from Safe.
Sure, Safe.
And funeral director from 6 Feet Under.
Michael C. Hall.
Michael C. Hall is correct for a one-point get, and that will take us into our score break. So at this point, I'm asking for the scores.
Thank you, Dave. I have 10. Joe has 8. Sarah D. Bunting, 4 points.
All right. So that means, Sarah D. Bunting, you are in the Gross Worth Equalizer Challenge Zone. Sarah D. Bunting, pick a number between 1 and 7. Discover what brand of card you will be answering from.
Number 2.
I'm happy to inform you, you missed the new Trivial Pursuit Friends edition by one number.
And I was not rooting for you to get that, although it would have been funny for me. Good luck.
I mean, again. Thank you.
This is the 80s edition. 80s edition Trivial Pursuit. Going to take 6 questions from the TV category. If you get 3 of them, you get 3 points. If you sweep, we double that to 6 points. So you could get 6 points here. Let's see what happens.
This could change everything.
What series featured Stephen Baldwin and Josh Brolin as Young Buffalo Bill and Wild Bill Hickok?
In the 80s.
Yeah, in the 80s. So says Totally 80s Edition Trivial Pursuit.
Young Guns, the TV show.
You are close. The Young Riders. The Young Riders.
Oh, all right.
Young Guns knockoff show. Yeah.
What former newsman, when Dan Rather stormed off the air, coolly noted, "I would have fired him"? Who would have fired Dan Rather for walking off the news set?
Some bitch.
Gosh.
What a cunt.
Fred Friendly?
Nope. Walter Cronkite.
Oh my.
All right.
I was right. Some bitch indeed.
Mm-hmm. What NBC series centered on a probationary angel named Jonathan Smith? Wasn't Jonathan Smith also the name of the guy from Lost in Space? Wasn't that Jonathan Smith?
Mm-hmm.
The doctor? Ooh, to be an angel.
The Highway to Heaven?
Correct.
Nice. Ooh.
What Growing Pains spinoff sent Coach Lubbock to California with his wife and 8 kids?
Just the 10 of us?
That's correct. Nice. You need one of these last two to get you 3 points. What quarrelsome comic book author was banned by David Letterman after appearing on the show in a boycott NBC t-shirt?
Quarrelsome comic book author?
Quarrelsome comic book author.
I don't fucking know. Crumb? R. Crumb?
Close.
That would have been my guess. Yeah.
Harvey Pekar.
Harvey Pekar.
Oh, right. Yes. Jesus.
All right. You need to get this one then. What series starred Jan Michael Vincent as a cello-playing recluse named Stringfellow Hawk? And Hawk is spelled with an E. Ooh. Stringfellow Hawk.
My God.
I don't know. Lady Hawk? Airwolf?
Airwolf is the correct answer.
No, really? Oh, wow.
Heartbreaker. All right, no points. So we're back to the game for the second half. I have flipped the order after Sarah just to give everybody somebody else to play off. But we're still going with Sarah. So Sarah, re-engage that brain. Your two occupations are fashion editor and neurologist. Fashion editor and neurologist. Two occupations from two different shows played by the same actor. Name that actor.
Fashion editor and neurologist.
I'll give you a hint.
Ellen Pompeo.
All right. I won't give you a hint.
Wendy Malick. I'm next.
Okay. But like, let's play the game.
Okay. Sorry.
Jesus. All right. Tara.
Wow. Yeah.
In punishment for your insolence.
Okay.
First of all, I'll give you the hint. Former soap opera star.
Yep.
I'm asking for the actor, but you have to say it in a very funny voice.
Wendy Malick.
That's not that funny. But So that's for the voice. But that's for the answer. All right. So that was fashion editor on Just Shoot Me, neurologist from Shrinking, and soap opera star, former from Hot in Cleveland.
Yep.
Tara, this is your actual question. Try to answer after I give the information.
Try to not be a dick about it? Okay, I will.
If you can.
Yep.
Grade me. I'm ever so good. Your two occupations are homemaker and captain.
Tony Danza.
All right, this will go to Joe. Homemaker, captain, nurse.
Homemaker, captain, nurse. Kate Mulgrew?
That's what I would have answered.
Sarah, you've got homemaker in Married with Children, a captain in Futurama, and a nurse from 8 Simple Rules.
Wow.
Katie Seagal?
You are correct for 1 point. Good pickup.
Nice.
Back to Joe. Your two occupations are police commissioner and ophthalmologist.
Police commissioner.
Yeah.
Ophthalmologist. It's a very specific type of
an immediate resplendent with ophthalmologist.
Yeah, I was going to say.
You resplendent
think I would
now.
Be able to zero in on that. I don't know. Kira Sedgwick?
All right, this will go to Sarah. Police commissioner, ophthalmologist, private investigator.
That's Mr. Tom Selleck.
That is Mr. Tom Selleck. We've got police commissioner from Blue Bloods.
Right.
Ophthalmologist from Friends, and Private Eye from Magnum PI.
There we go.
Sarah, your two occupations to start us off are plastic surgeon and orthopedic surgeon.
Talk about running the gamut.
Try the surgeon special. It's delicious.
Mm. Rick Rossovich.
Love it.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Plastic surgeon, orthopedic surgeon.
Sure.
Secret Service special agent.
Mark Harmon.
That is correct.
Good pull.
Plastic surgeon, St. Elsewhere. Orthopedic surgeon, Chicago Hope. And of course, he's doing that Secret Service special agent thing navally on NCIS. That is Mark Harmon.
You guys need to know how close I was to saying Timothy Busfield because I knew it was someone from West Wing. It's like,
and then I was like, is it Ron Butterfield? What's the actor's name? Which I could never remember.
Nope,
it's Michael
me neither.
Something I can never remember.
That right. guy.
Tara, you're in the hot seat for question 17.
Spread Eagle.
We've got a captain, lots of captains here, and a gynecologist.
Jonathan Silverman.
To Joe, captain, gynecologist, mystery novelist.
Right.
Captain, gynecologist, mystery novelist. Probably not Angela Lansbury.
Vagina, she wrote.
I'm just going to say Angela Lansbury because I'm going to feel dumb in the Julia Louis-Dreyfus rule if I don't. So just say wrong. I don't know.
Okay. Giving up?
No, he said Angela Lansbury.
Oh, Angela Lansbury. You're incorrect there. Okay. All right. So we move to Sarah for captain from Firefly, gynecologist from Desperate Housewives, and mystery novelist from Castle. Who is that actor?
Oh, I am pretty fucking mad that Angela Lansbury was not on Firefly. They wouldn't have to talk shit about it if she were. But she wasn't. That was Nathan Fillion.
Yes. Nice.
Another 1 point get. Back to Joe. We've got advertising executive and press secretary.
I'm really hoping this is Heather Locklear.
You are correct. 3 points.
Yay. Nice.
Wow.
Advertising executive from D&D from Melrose Place.
Of course.
That's right.
Knowledge retrieval. Brain working.
Business.
Press secretary from Spin City. And your third was going to be rookie police officer from everybody's favorite Shatner property, TJ Hooker.
TJ Hooker. Nice.
All right. This is question. This is for Sarah. Your two occupations are drug trafficker.
It's a job.
And VP of Northeast Sales.
It's not a job. It's a calling.
Yeah, that's right.
Drug trafficker and VP of Northeast Sales. This sadly is not as narrow as it should be. So I'm going to open the bidding with Bryan Cranston.
All right. Decent guess. Not correct. We go to Tara with drug trafficker, VP of Northeast Sales, Detective Chief.
Wagner Moura.
All right, Joe, you get the shows. Okay. Do you need them, Joe?
Yes.
Would you like to hear them like a good contestant? Great. Oh. Drug trafficker from The Wire, VP of Northeast Sales from The Office.
Okay.
Detective Chief from Luther. Who played all those characters?
This would be Idris Elba.
You are correct for 1 point. Okay. All right, we're getting down to the end here. Only 5 questions left. Let's make them count. Tara.
Yep.
Librarian. Receptionist.
Librarian.
Yeah.
Pretty sure it's not Anthony Stewart Head. Okay, I'm just going to say it, Anthony Stewart Head. I don't have a better answer.
Yeah, incorrect. Move to Joe. Librarian, receptionist, and caterer.
Okay. It's got to be Megan Mullally.
You are correct. Yay. Librarian from Parks and Rec, receptionist Will and Grace, caterer Party Down. Good
nice.
For two.
Nice.
Never think of her having a job on that show.
I know.
I know, right?
All right, Joe, let's see if you can get a 3 point on this one.
Okay.
Occupation number one, inmate. Sure. Occupation number two, psychiatrist.
All right. I'm going to guess this is the Oz to Law and Order pipeline, and it's J.K. Simmons.
You are correct.
Right.
That was that was those two shows. We also had Assistant Police Chief from The Closer waiting in the wings.
Sure.
J.K. Simmons, 3 point get.
Oh, wow.
All right, this is everybody's last question, so let's get scores.
Well, it was close at one time, and now it's not anymore. Sarah has 8. I have 14. Joe has 18.
Oh, wow. Okay, let's finish it up with Sarah's question. She is on deck with nurse and police officer.
The two genders.
Nurse and police officer.
Juliana Margulies.
Tutara.
I would have said that too, yes.
All right, this next is a giveaway, so you should get 2 points here.
Okay.
Nurse, police officer, salon owner / money launderer.
Niecy Nash.
Niecy Nash is correct for 2 points. You and you also have the start of the next question, Tara.
Okay.
DEA agent and prince.
And prince?
Yeah. You just sort of fell into the job. That's still a job.
Oh, God. Pedro Pascal?
You're correct.
What?
Nice. Hey.
He's a prince on Game of Thrones?
He's a prince of Game of Thrones. Yes. And we had Bounty Hunter waiting in the wings there for you from The Mandalorian.
Fuck.
All right, 3-point answer. Nicely done. Joe.
Pulls into the lead.
Last question.
Good luck, Joe.
Your two occupations are gangster and stick-up man.
Boy.
Again, running the gamut.
Gangster and stick-up man.
Ugh. Originally, this game was give them all 3 occupations and let them figure it out, but I'm being cool and I'm reserving the giveaway for the the last one, so...
Oh,
I don't
man.
Know if the giveaway for J.K. Simmons was police chief. Who the hell remembers the fucking clothes?
Well, sometimes I just Sarah. Want people to get it.
Gangster and stick-up man.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just going to say, if gangster isn't the giveaway, then it's probably not James Gandolfini. But I'm going to say maybe, but if it was Buscemi, it would be like bootlegger rather than gangster. Yeah. Just permit me to work this out for like a second.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Got nothing but time, Joe.
Yes. World's ending. Nothing but time. No, I'm going to probably say it is probably Sopranos, and I'm just going to say it's Michael Imperioli.
Michael Imperioli!
No.
Oh, Dave.
You used the tone of voice that said I got it right.
Sarah, gangster, stick-up man, college biology teacher. I don't know if that one's going to help Sarah in particular, but I think for most people, that would be a giveaway. All right. So once again, gangster in one show, stick-up man in a second show, college biology teacher in a third show. Who's that actor?
I got nothing but this. It's like blotted out all other names in my brain. So Michael K. Williams.
You're correct.
Yeah.
Michael K. Hell Williams is correct. Community. Gangster, Boardwalk Empire. Remember that? He played Scratchy or Chalky or something like that.
Yeah,
Stick-up man, obviously, Omar Little from The Wire. And then college biology teacher was from his stint on Community. That was Michael K. Williams. That. And that is regulation. So it's time for our final scores.
Squeaka. Sarah finished with 10. Joe, 18. Pulling Pedro Pascal out of my ass.
That's incredible.
We all
that's
love
the place
to
pull it, right?
I know. Better
luck next time.
All right. I've got the tiebreaker here. So first person to shout out the correct actor name, I'll just start dripping information, gets a steel meal for future use. Here we go. Occupation number 1, newspaper features writer. Newspaper features writer. If you actually get it just on one, I'm going to give you 3 steel meals.
Kyle Chandler.
No, incorrect.
Okay, I'm out.
Newspaper features writer and secondly, aspiring actor. Newspaper features writer.
Matt LeBlanc?
Nope. Newspaper features writer, aspiring actor, regional manager.
Steve Carell?
Nope. But you're close.
You gotta take a trip.
Anybody can answer here. Everybody, let's go. All right, here we go. Newspaper features writer from the TV show Afterlife. Aspiring actor from Extras. Ricky Gervais is your answer.
Oh, Jesus.
Joe, you Americocentric pig.
Damn.
All right. Today belongs to Tara Arrieta.
Tara.
Tara.
Wow, well great done. Game. Well done, everybody.
That was fun.
Thank you, Amy.
Yeah, that was good.
Thank you, Amy.
All right, that is it for this episode of Extra Hot Great. We decorated the podcast with a little mid-century modern before going around the dial with stops at Last One Laughing, UK, The Pit, Adolescence, Shrinking, and Gone Girls. Joe successfully scaled the peaks and valleys of The Simpsons' Mary Poppins parody for the Nonak. We crowned winner and losers of the week. And Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time from Amy. Next up, Mublin on Extra, Extra Hot Great. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David Teagle, and on behalf of Tara Ariano.
If we're done here, I'm going to go put Pedro Pascal back in my ass.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Oakley Doakley Doo.
And Joe Reed.
Palm Springs, here I come.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Grit.
I'm sorry, young man. You're not what we're looking for.
You're telling me, you blue-haired witch?
I heard that.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.